Father, thank you for this Sunday school, and I pray for your blessing upon it, and I do pray that you give those which have come out just what they need, and may the Spirit of God apply the Word of God to their hearts and their lives, that it make a difference and it help them out and assist them and help them to grow spiritually. In Jesus' name, amen. Proverbs chapter 16, and we're picking it up in verse 27. We've looked at that a little bit already, and let's just go back and catch where we're at. In Proverbs 16, 27, 28, and 29, you have a description of, number one, an ungodly man, and then a froward man, and then a violent man. These three can be the same man. You can have different men, one that's an ungodly man, and one that's a froward man, and one that's a violent man, but you can have a man that possesses one of these characteristics, two of these characteristics, or all three of them. And in the context, you've got a description of a man. He gets progressively worse, and it shows you more the details of his ungodly nature. An ungodly man diggeth up evil, and in his lips there is as a burning fire. Here's a man, he's an ungodly man, he digs up dirt on people. He tries to, instead of letting people enjoy fellowship, he digs up dirt and he sows strife. You notice that by the next verse, where it says, a froward man soweth strife. Well, it goes hand in hand with the ungodly man that diggeth up evil. And these two, as I said, can be one and the same. So an ungodly man diggeth up evil. Instead of allowing, you know, somebody gets saved or they want to get right with God and they start doing right, and instead of letting the person do right and helping them out to do right, he goes and tries to dig up dirt on the person and make his way rough, make it hard, make it difficult. An ungodly man diggeth up evil. And it says, in his lips there is as a burning fire. Now come to James chapter 3, and we made mention of this as we closed last time. But let's look at this thing in James 3. It says here, in his lips there is as a burning fire. Well, within your lips can be, you might find your tongue. And in James chapter 3, the tongue is said to be a fire. Go to James chapter 3 and look at, we'll begin with verse number 6. We'll go ahead and go back to verse 5 instead. Begin with verse 5. Even so, the tongue is a little member, and boasteth great things. Behold, how great a matter a little fire kindleth. The tongue is described as being a fire. It's a little member, but it boasts great things, and it says, behold, how great a matter a little fire kindleth. It's like the tongue's just a little fire. It's like a little match, and yet it starts a big forest fire. And then verse 6 says this, and the tongue is a fire. So it describes a person's tongue as being a fire. And the fire and the damage that your tongue can do is just almost unlimited. It's almost unlimited except for just the limits that we find placed upon us on this earth. And that's, I mean, it's pretty vast. And the limitations are, they're not too many except for just confined to this world. But the damage it can do, like I said, just a little match can start a whole forest on fire. It can start a whole house on fire. It can burn the thing down. And your tongue can do similar damage in other people's lives. The tongue's a fire, it's a world of iniquity. Verse 6, a world of iniquity, so is the tongue among our members, that it defileth the whole body, and notice, setteth on fire the course of nature. That's again like the match setting a forest on fire. Setteth on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire of hell. And the Bible doesn't have a lot of great things to say about our tongue and our natural condition. And our own old man, our Adam, our old earthly Adam, doesn't say much good about our tongue. So our tongue's got to be brought into subjection and subdued by our master. And the Lord's got to take control of our tongue, or else we can do a great deal of damage with it. Okay, that's where he gets getting to in Proverbs 16:27. An ungodly man diggeth up evil. First thing he does is he goes to work and he tries to dig up some dirt on somebody. And the second thing he does is when he finds the dirt, he goes and he starts to spread it. In his lips there is as a burning fire. Verse 28, a froward man soweth strife, and a whisperer separateth chief friends. He's sowing strife. It's like he's planting seeds of discord. The Bible talks in another place about sowing discord. And when we talk about sowing, we're talking about the idea of sowing seed. We sow the seed of the Word of God in hopes that it will grow up later on and bear fruit. And in the same manner, somebody's sowing strife and sowing discord. Froward man soweth strife. He's dropping little things here and there, saying things that, they just plant seeds of doubt or question about somebody else's character in their minds or what they're going through. And these seeds, ultimately, they grow up. And it separates, as it says at the end of verse 28, separates chief friends. Just a little thing you plant, a little thing you drop with your tongue, can grow up and can bother, you know, bother somebody, trouble somebody. Christians are, they're terrible at this stuff. Christians do more damage with their tongue, I guess, than into the body of Christ, than a lot of things you've seen. But they probably about with about anything else they do in their life. You know, if a person goes off sometimes and lives in sin, bad news. But sometimes he just isolates himself and doesn't bother anybody but himself. But a Christian that gets half in and half out and gets around people and starts running that mouth, boy, you run that mouth and you're not filled with the Spirit, there's no telling what's going to come out. And you're not filled with the Spirit, and you're, instead of ministering to other people, you're doing damage and to the body of Christ. The tongue is said to be a fire. Come to Ephesians 4. Let me show you one time again what your tongue is supposed to be doing and what your words are supposed to be doing. Ephesians 4. Ephesians 4, and let it sink down so that you understand, and there was no mistake about it. But your tongue's supposed to be doing something better than cutting people up and slashing them up. Ephesians 4:29. Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying. Alright, so what comes out of your mouth is supposed to be good for the use of edifying. It's supposed to edify somebody. How much of what you say edifies people? In your family life, you get talking around the house and, you know, words get flying and things get going. How much of what you say do you actually try to make good to the use of edification of your family? We're to edify one another. Let all things be done to edify. But that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace unto the hearers. Now, the root, I guess, of getting your tongue subdued and in subjection, there's a couple places, and one is just getting tired of putting your foot in your mouth, as I mentioned last time, and another one is having a desire to help people out with what you say, a love for them, a real charitable love that desires their edification and their well-being, and not the exaltation of yourself. Well, where we're at in Christianity is in your own family's path, we just get our mouths running to the place where we can chop everybody else down so that then they're all down below us and we've exalted ourselves up to the king of the hill. So that we want to make ourselves our own God so that we try to win these word battles with everybody that we talk with. It gets ridiculous. It's a game that Christians play. They try to one-up each other, you know, every time they say something. Pretty soon, they're in bad trouble. Did you ever read that place in the New Testament? It said, but if ye bite and devour one another, take heed that ye be not consumed one of another. It's a dangerous game you get in when you start playing the game of just chopping people down and seeing who can bring the worst cut down and stuff. And people will wind up damaged. It hurts them. Lots of times what we say, that we may not realize the effect that it has on people. I remember I was in grade school, and you know how you are in grade school, and people divide off in different groups, and you say things about different people, and you get off with your groups, and you make fun of people and so forth. But one time I let it go beyond the group that I was gathered into and the people that I hung around with, and we were between classes, and I can remember it to this day, walking, I believe it was downstairs, probably to our science class. And there's this one girl in our school, and we called her name was Lisa Howard, and we called her Elsie after the boarding cow, you know. And she wasn't gigantic and overweight or anything like that, but she was pretty big stature. But we called her Elsie. And one time, I don't remember what I said exactly, but I remember the situation. But I was going downstairs, and I said something to her, and that wasn't very nice. It was on the lines of this, you know, cutting her down, chopping down. And I said that thing, and I realized when I said that I hurt her feelings. And it might not seem like much, but it got a hold of me and I realized the damage you can do with your tongue. And I had a little bit of compassion probably for one of the first times in my life as I realized that me as an individual, and all I was doing was really messing around trying to make myself feel good and look good in front of other people. But I realized I reached her and I had an effect on her life, but I didn't edify her at all. I hurt her. And makes you aware of what you can do with your tongue. That's what we get into, though, in Christianity. Yeah, I mean, you get talking with people, and you got to watch yourself. You got to put a check on that tongue. I pray for the Lord to set a watch upon the door of your lips. And this is what an ungodly and a froward man do, and sad to say, Christians possess these characteristics many times. A froward man soweth strife, and a whisperer separateth chief friends. Go back to chapter 6 of Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 6. Right, Proverbs 6, we've got six things that the Lord hates and seven that are an abomination to Him. And Proverbs 6, look at verse 19. At the end of the list of the things that He hates is a false witness that speaketh lies. There's that tongue messing up again. And he that soweth discord among brethren. Now, notice how the last two go hand in hand. A false witness that speaketh lies and he that soweth discord. And the idea of this can be rumors. A person that speaks a rumor about somebody else that isn't true is a false witness. He's witnessing falsely to what his neighbor or his friend has done or the other person's done. That'd be like a person that bears false witness against his neighbor, which is one of the Ten Commandments that you're not supposed to do. But it's a false witness that speaketh lies, and he that soweth discord among brethren. It's a person that among Christian brothers sows discord. And this can be done by spreading rumors, by running that mouth where it shouldn't be run, and you just got to put a check on it. And it's strange to think that the Lord would say He hates this, and this type of stuff's abomination to Him. I mean, if I gave you a piece of paper and asked you to write down what you think the 5 or 10 greatest sins of this day and age would be, you know, what would you put on it? Just, I mean, naturally, you'd probably think, well, getting drunk and doing drugs and murdering, abortion and adultery and, you know, pornography and things like that. And you put all that stuff down, homosexuality, and you get all that list down, but you forget what God says. And God says He hates a proud look, a lying tongue, and a heart that deviseth wicked imaginations, and things like that. And of course, a lot of them go there. But then He just says, a false witness that speaketh lies, and he that soweth discord among brethren. Now, I'll tell you one thing. If you're not at the place, if you don't get to the place where the Lord gets control of that tongue, and you're filled with the Spirit, then whether you know it or not, there's going to be times when you sow discord among brethren by what you say, unless you just keep your mouth shut. Because you get that tongue speaking, and that tongue isn't, and that mouth, and that body, and that spirit isn't filled with the Spirit of God, wrong things are bound to come out. All right, a froward man soweth strife, and a whisperer separated chief friends. A whisperer. Come here, I've got to tell you a secret about somebody. Like the infamous prayer meetings where people gather around to pray and say, you know, I'm just bringing this up because I don't know that this is going on, but I'm worried and concerned about this guy, and I've heard this, and of course I heard it from a true source, and I want you to pray about this brother, you know. And you don't, it's a strange thing, but oftentimes they don't have a burden. They get this burden to tell, and that's about the only burden they got. They just want to spread the dirt. So an ungodly man does that. Digs up evil, and his lips is as a burning fire. And a froward man soweth strife, and a whisperer separates chief friends. Somebody that says the wrong thing about somebody can have two people, they're best friends, and then somebody else goes over and, you know, says, well, did you hear this about this guy here? And he said this about you. And, you know, chief friends, good friends, best friends can be separated by somebody that doesn't mind his own business. The Bible goes on later to say in Proverbs, debate thy cause with thy neighbor himself and discover not a secret to another. Christians, they don't pay attention to many of those verses though. Verse 29, a violent man enticeth his neighbor and leadeth him into the way that is not good. Here you've got a man, he's said to be a violent man, and he entices his neighbor. The way of the wicked seduces the righteous. It tries to draw them into it. We read about that in Proverbs 12. But this man, he's enticing his neighbor, and he's leading him into the way that is not good. It's like somebody trying to corrupt somebody, like a kid in school that gets mixed up with the wrong crowd, and his neighbor that he sits there, that's what our teachers used to call them when we sat next to them. They called them our neighbors. You know, don't talk with your neighbor. But his neighbor talks to him and leads him into the way that is not good. And this happens a lot too. Look in 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter 2. This is a violent man. He entices his neighbor and he leads him into the way that is not good. 2 Peter chapter 2. All right, in 2 Peter 2, let's go to verse number 18. For when they speak great swelling words of vanity, they are speaking with their mouth and they're enticing their neighbor here. They speak great swelling words of vanity. They allure. Now they're leading him into the way that is not good. They allure through the lusts of the flesh, through much wantonness, those that were clean escape from them who live in error. Now get the last part of that. They allure, these are the people that they allure. They allure these people into sin. And here are the group, here's the class of people they're called. They're called those that were clean escape from them who live in error. In other words, you've got people that are living right. They're living in their clean escape from the people who live in error. They're away from the people that live in error, away from the people that are living the wrong way. And yet some people, through great swelling words of vanity and people as a violent man spoken about here in Proverbs 16, they allure these people and lead them into the way that's not good. It's somebody that corrupts somebody else. I don't know how much damage you did to other people before you got saved, but there's a number of us, and I haven't done as much as a lot of people, and a really very small scale as far as the influence on a lot of people, but I've contributed to people and their delinquency and their sin and so forth, and I've, in my times past before my salvation, I've been a bad influence on some folks. And when I think about that, how I've, there's been times when I've allured some people into some wrong things and doing some wrong things. No, not as bad as other people, but pretty bad enough. And I think about that, and I think, you know, I've got to make up for some lost time here now. I've got to try to make amends. One of the first things I tried to do after I got saved was go to a lot of my friends and witness to them. I tried to set up times to witness to them. Some of them were easier to witness to than others, and some of them were a little more difficult, but I tried to give them a testimony somehow. And I blew some opportunities. And Lord, I didn't even, there was a time shortly after I got saved, I did not even have to seek one person out. But the Lord brought him across my path. But he was inviting me to do some other things. And I wasn't too stable at that time. And I just, instead of witnessing to him, I just let the conversation pass and got away from him without getting messed up myself. But I blew some opportunities. There's some people that I did have a bad influence on, and now I've got, I feel like I want to make up for lost time, you know. I want to have the right influence on some people instead of continuing to lead them in the wrong path. But people do that, and perhaps you've done that. And if you have in times past, you've led a great deal of a great number of people astray. You might not be able to go back and salvage everybody you led astray. But I tell you what, through a good, sold-out Christian life, you can have an influence on them and an impact that may make a difference. Maybe some of them aren't even around anymore. You don't know where they're around. If they're alive, you can still pray for them. And if they're not, I'll tell you what else you can do. You can at least try to salvage the lives of some other people and try to outdo with good what you did with bad. Now that you're saved and born again, you can take the righteousness that you've got, and you can take the answers that you've got, and you can try to get them off on other people and influence people with those instead of and make up for lost time for what you did in the past. A violent man enticeth his neighbor. Here's a man, he's doing right, he isn't bothering anybody, and this guy sees him and he says, well, I'm gonna get him, I'm gonna mess him up. He enticeth his neighbor and leadeth him into the way that is not good. So people that were previously clean escape from them who live in error, now they're found to be enticed and led into the way that is not good. So that's a description of a man, ungodly, froward, and violent. Words of three different types of men there too also. All right, verse number 30 is saying about this man here in verse 29. He shutteth his eyes to devise froward things. Moving his lips, he bringeth evil to pass. Now notice how in verse 30, he talks about the man as a singular man. He shutteth his eyes to devise froward things. And notice the froward man had been spoken about in verse 28. And then he talked about the violent man. He starts off 30, doesn't say they shut their eyes. He says he, which indicates that this also can be just one man, one person here. He shutteth his eyes to devise froward things. He closes his eyes and he's into meditation to devise froward things. You know, some people get into real deep meditation. Instead of meditating on the Word of God, they get into the TM, Transcendental Meditation, and the other different, Buddhism and things like that, where they get really into the meditation and the yoga and the meditation, sometimes it goes along with that. He shutteth his eyes to devise froward things. And that's what goes on at that stuff sometimes. When they shut their eyes and they're in meditation, they get themselves in a passive state and devise evil things. But also like a man that goes to, or just leans back in his chair and closes his eyes and tries to figure out how he can work out his evil desires and evil practices. He shutteth his eyes to devise evil, or to devise froward things. Moving his lips, he bringeth evil to pass. And he thinks about it with his mind, and then he begins to move his lips, and when he starts speaking about it, first of all, it's inside of him. He devises his plan, then he begins to speak about it, and as he begins to speak about it, it becomes more real. After he hears himself talk about it, he becomes more real, and he puts the plans into actions, and he brings it to pass. Moving his lips, he bringeth evil to pass. There's a lot of things that if they were to be stopped in here before they got to here, they'd be stopped in your brain before they got to your mouth, they could cut off a lot of trouble. And which leads you back up to verse 27, with the burning fire in his lips, and the things, the way he speaks. So he says, moving his lips, he bringeth evil to pass. And now in verse 31, the hoary head is a crown of glory. The hoary head, like the gray-haired or a white-haired man, a man who's grown up in years and his hair's turned to a white or a bright gray type of a color. The hoary head is a crown of glory if it be found in the way of righteousness. Leaning more to the white hair. You know, we talked about the hoar frost in the Bible, and which is a type of kind of a white thing. The hoary head is a crown of glory. So, but when the man gets older and his hair begins to turn that color, it's said to be a crown of glory if, and there's a stipulation put on it, if it be found in the way of righteousness. I seem to remember in Florida, there's this big church down on, I think it was on Brent Lane, and it was called the Gateway Church of Christ, as I remember. Big one, probably the biggest Church of Christ I ever saw. They ran a lot of people and got a lot of people in there and had big things. It seems I remember one time on their sign outside, they had part of this verse on there, and it says, the hoary head is a crown of glory. I don't know why they're putting that on there, or I don't know what they're trying to do, or really what the purpose was. But it seems to me I remember just seeing that. But they left off the last part of the verse. And they left off the part that said, if it be found in the way of righteousness. And you can't leave off the last part of the verse and get the truth of the whole verse. Because just an old gray-haired or an old white-haired man is not glory. And his head isn't a crown of glory to him. It's a crown of glory if it's found in the way of righteousness. And this would be a saint of God that's lived for years and years and years and done right. And now he's grown older and his hair's begun to turn color. And this is said to be a crown of glory to him if it be found in the way of righteousness. And it's an honor to the individual. It talks a little, we'll get another verse a little bit later that speaks a little bit about this also. Verse number 32. He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that ruleth his spirit than he that taketh a city. That's a good verse, real good right there. First half of it says, he that is slow to anger is better than the mighty. That's indicating that if you have control over your wrath and your anger, you're slow to anger, then you're better than a mighty man. The mighty men that the world think are great, you're better than the mighty. Mighty conquerors or the mighty rulers of the world or the idols and stars of this earth and this world, you're better than them. He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty. You're better than somebody that's able to whip, anybody that's able to whip the strongest man on this earth or people that are considered to be real strong. You're better than that if you're able to rule your own spirit. I saw a verse like this in chapter 14, if you look over there for a moment, 14:29. said, he that is slow to wrath is of great understanding. So a person who's slow to get angry, he has great understanding. And a person of great understanding, that great understanding causes you to be slow to wrath. It causes you to be able to be slow to before you get upset. And we spoke about that in chapter 14. Now this verse says, he that is slow to anger is better than the mighty. And then the last part says, and he that ruleth his spirit than he that taketh the city. It's a person that can have control over his own spirit. He rules his own spirit. He's slow to anger. He has control over his spirit. Then he's better than the person that's able to conquer a city, able to take a city. And there's some great implications in that right there. Just showing you that a little bit of self-control and some temperance makes you better than what the earth and the world considers mighty men, and better than people that can literally go out and conquer a city and take a city. So that's quite an indication of what the Lord thinks about somebody that's able to rule his spirit and control his anger. Verse number 33, the lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. Now this is the idea of, and they use it a lot in the Old Testament, of lots, casting lots, like drawing straws, or they would do it perhaps, put maybe a bunch of stones in a bag, or stones in somebody's lap, and you have one that's marked, and the person that gets the marked one is the one that gets whatever they're drawing for, or however it goes. But this is called the lot. The lot is cast into the lap. The lot is cast into the lap, and the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 18. You'll be able to see it on the same page there. But Proverbs 18, verse 18, talks about the lot again. And here it says, the lot causeth contentions to cease, and parteth between the mighty. And here the idea is, if you've got trouble or got contentions and you're trying to settle the matter and you can't get things straight, one way to settle it is just say, well, all right, I tell you what, we'll just draw straws on the matter, or we'll draw lots or take lots, and then whoever wins, wins, and we'll do it this way, or something like that. That's the idea. And that is true. The lot causeth contention to cease and parteth between the mighty. Be like doing eeny, meeny, miny, mo, or something like that. And lots of times people who can't decide who's going to go first or second, if they do that, it causes contention to cease, and everybody figures, well, it's been done fair and square. That's the idea and the teaching of the verse. And here it says, the lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. I'll go to the book of Jonah. This took place in Jonah's time. Jonah chapter 1. In Jonah chapter 1, Jonah was a stowaway on a ship. He was running and fleeing from the presence of the Lord. And the ship began to get in trouble. And so the heathen on the ship wanted to find out where this trouble was coming upon and where it came from. And in verse number 7, it says, and they said every one to his fellow, come and let us cast lots, that we may know for whose cause this evil is upon us. So they cast lots, and it says here, so they cast lots, and the lot fell upon Jonah. And so what they did, and these are heathen, mind you now, they cast lots, and somehow the lot fell upon Jonah, and they understood that because of Jonah, they already suspected him. I mean, look at verse number six. So the shipmaster came to him and said unto him, what meanest thou, sleeper? Arise, call upon thy God, if so be that God will think upon us, that we perish not. They already suspected that Jonah could help the situation out, that he might have something to do with it. So verse 7, they cast lots, and then it says the lot fell upon Jonah. Now it worked then, and it worked for them, but this type of stuff doesn't always work for us. I mean, they've changed a little bit. And that's where it started. And it says that the lot's cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. In other words, like the Lord gives you the right lot. This is what they did when they were, and there's arguments about this down through the ages of the church age, but that's what they did when they were choosing that disciple, remember, to replace Judas. And they had to choose between Matthias and Joseph, which was called Barsabbas. And they prayed for the Lord to cast a perfect lot. And the lot fell upon Matthias there, and he was made the apostle to replace him. And some of them will say, well, they did right, and then they got the replacement for the apostle. And then others, other preachers will say that they made a great, tremendous mistake, and this man was, you know, never to be heard from again. You don't find anything else written about him again. So there's been great discussion about that. But the word lot there, that's where we get our word here, lottery. And so that's one big thing today. People want to win the lottery. How many times have you heard from relatives, well, if I ever win the lottery, you know, they're going to fix you up forever. And you know, my parents buy it, and if they ever win it, I won't mind them letting me divide the inheritance and divide the spoil. Sure, I could find something to use for it. It's like a man said, when in Christianity, you're looked down upon if some people look down upon you if you're filthy rich and they think you couldn't be spiritual, and others look down upon you if you're filthy poor and say, well, you ought to work and get things going and moving, and you can't just please them. But he says one thing money does in Christianity is it gives you more options. And there's a lot of truth about that as far as how you can serve the Lord or what you can do for him. But then usually what happens when the people get the money, then the devil gets them and the Lord doesn't get it. That's usually the way those things go. But that's lottery, and it comes from the word lot. And I know one thing about the lottery. I mean, it just doesn't lend to real spiritual living in these days and age. I read an article, it's been, I guess, months ago now, I came across an article. There was this preacher, I may have told you before, there's this preacher that preached against the lottery, and he preached to his congregation, told them that they shouldn't mess around with it, and it was of the devil and things like that. And his wife went out privately and bought a lottery ticket, and she won thousands of dollars, you know. So they had a big article and write up about that in the paper. And of course, you know, she kept the money and tied it to the church, and things worked out all right. But those type of things right there, they get a spirit with them, and it can become a compulsion. I was in the barber shop the other day and heard a man talking about how ever since the lottery came out, he spent $10 a week, you know, on lottery tickets. And that's been, I don't think he's been doing that well. And I don't know, maybe he's talking about 5 years, or I can't remember if it was ever since it came out. That comes to, you know, about $520 a year, and you multiply that by years, that's a lot of money that just goes down the drain. And, of course, that's how they make so much money on it. You ever realize how they can afford to give so much away? Well, you figure it out, and you figure out if they're selling $1 a ticket, and you've got how many millions of people in New York, and this is just New York State Lottery, if they only sell, you know, about $1 million a day, I mean, that's $1 million coming in. And then if you win $9 million, they're only paying you off several hundred thousand dollars a year. But they're making big bucks on that stuff. Revenue coming in. Somebody's found the chicken and laid the golden egg, or the goose that laid the golden egg, I guess. But lottery, see, it fits, you get into this gambling thing, and you begin to tamper with the providence of God, and it becomes a dangerous thing. It can become a compulsion with you, always wanting to buy a lottery ticket and always wanting to buy a raffle ticket. And I used to work, before I got saved, at this store. I couldn't get a senior in high school, and you had to be 18 or so to buy lottery tickets. But since I worked there, when nobody else was around, I could buy what I wanted to. So I buy these instant lottery tickets and just, you know, wipe them off. I never get nothing. But it drives you crazy. And it becomes a thing where your heart gets fixed on it, see? And your heart gets, it begins to take away your heart. And your heart begins to become... entangled and ensnared with the deceitfulness of riches and the lust of other things entering in. And instead of meditating upon how to be spiritually rich, you're always thinking about, well, if I win the lottery or if I win this contest, then I'm going to do this and that, and I'm going to be physically filthy rich and then have it made. And you think that if you get rich like that, then you've got all kinds of security. But you won't. I mean, as soon as you get rich like that, then you've got more options, see? And you're going to say, well, now I can do this and do that. People, I found this, most people live pretty much on the same scale, whether they've got a little money or a lot of money, fighting to pay their bills. And when you get a lot of money, you just buy bigger things and incur bigger bills usually. And it's just because people don't use it generally rightly. Now this verse here says, the lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord, indicating And this is what you want to remember, indicating that God does have his hand upon what comes out on in the lot, in the gambling table, in the lottery, and everything else. God has his hand on it. And it's not like God doesn't mean that God's blessing you or blessing somebody necessarily when they win like that, but it means he has his hand on what takes place. He has his hands on the cards that are dealt and everything else. The whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. He can make it fall out whichever way he wants. And he can make it fall out to keep you tangled up for the rest of your life if your heart's not right to him, whereas you just keep on going after that type of stuff. But he's got his hand in it. The lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. You know the way they pick the numbers in the lottery? You ever see that? When I was little, I'd watch it. When we had the lottery over in Illinois, they got these things like these ping pong balls with the numbers and this thing with a vacuum like, and they're going all around and they do something and all of a sudden one comes up. We had, I think, had a three-digit one in Illinois, and I used to, after I got saved, thinking about that, I'm thinking, you know what's going to probably happen one of these days? Probably going to happen one of these days, they're going to have this big world lottery and they're going to draw numbers, and this may not take place, this, I thought probably going to happen something like this. They're going to draw numbers, and this is going to be the big number that everybody's going to cash in. And they're going to bring the first ping pong ball up, and it's going to get a six. And they're going to bring the second ping pong ball up, and it's going to be a six. And they're going to bring out ping pong ball number three. And the great number that this world's going to go by is going to be 666, Revelation 13:18. That may not take place like that, but boy, they sure got the way paved to do something like that. And everybody's mind sure is in tune with numbers these days. All right, the lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. Any questions? We're going to have to close there. Running out of time this morning. Okay, we'll take a break before the main survey. Thank you. 3 out of here also.
Proverbs 11 and 9.
Proverbs 11 and 16.
And Proverbs 11 and 2.
Okay, chapter 12.
A couple verses out of here. Proverbs chapter 12,
verse number 5. Rather make that 5 good too, but I want to say 15. Proverbs 12, 15.
Proverbs 12, verse 15. Proverbs 12, verse 26.
15 and 26. Okay, Proverbs 13, verse 3 and verse 20. Verse 3 and verse 20. There really is a lot of other good verses in chapter 13 that are well worth your time to become real familiar with and also commit to memory. But 3 and 20 are two good ones also. Proverbs 14, though there's several in here, I just picked out one that will be good. And that's Proverbs 14, verse 14. 14, 14. Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 28. Verse 28 and verse 33. And then in chapter 16, Proverbs 16, verse 16, and Proverbs 16, verse 22. Proverbs 16, verse 22. And I suggested 16:22, which says, "Understanding is a wellspring of life unto him that hath it." Especially the first half of the verse, at the end is good too, but the instruction of fools is folly. But I suggested that because it's been my experience that lots of times Christians, they lack understanding. They really do. And they seem to give up on understanding their conditions or understanding things that take place in their life too early. And understanding truly is a wellspring of life, as we talked about when we looked at that verse. And it'll help you to get through sometimes. Sometimes nothing else will help you get through. That's a good thing to have. And the Bible says, after getting wisdom, which is a principle, then we are to, with all our getting, get understanding. So a verse on that would be definitely beneficial. Okay, Proverbs chapter 17, verse number 1. And later on, Lord willing, I will give you one or more verses in 17, just suggested memory verses. Okay, Proverbs chapter 17, and verse number 1. And we begin this chapter, and it begins with this verse. Better is a dry morsel and quietness therewith than a house full of sacrifices with strife. We looked at this verse in conjunction with another verse. So let me just take you back to Proverbs chapter 15, where we already looked at this verse as a cross-reference with Proverbs 15, 17. Make it 16 and 17. In 16 and 17, chapter 15, we read, "Better is little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble therewith." The idea that we're getting is it's better to just have a little bit in the house and have peace and have the blessings of God there than to have a whole bunch of things and not have any blessings from the Lord. Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble therewith. So you do better just to have a little bit and then, as opposed to having a bunch and having a hard time with it, trouble with it. Then verse 17 said, "Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a stalled ox and hatred therewith." In other words, you better just sit down to a supper of vegetables, not being able to afford anything more than that, than to have an ox out there in the stall waiting to be butchered displaying a little bit of the wealth that you have, and yet you have a house that's filled with hatred. So better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a stall of ox and hatred therewith. Now these two verses are very much like this verse in Proverbs 17, verse 1. And it's really a great truth, especially when we consider the way we strive in our society for certain things. It's very good to consider verses like this. 17:1, better is a dry morsel. It'd be like maybe a stale, crusty piece of bread, or just a piece of bread without any butter or without anything to drink. Just a dry morsel. A cracker or something in your house is all you have to eat. Better is a dry morsel and quietness therewith. In this house, they don't have a whole lot of fancy things to eat, but they've got something, and they've got quietness. They've got peace. He said it'd be better to have that than to have this. An house full of sacrifices with strife. When you consider it, it's kind of a comparison between being poor and just having a little bit, and yet you have the blessings of the Lord and the peace of the Lord and the presence of the Holy Spirit, and then having a whole bunch, and yet you have chaos in your household. You have strife, contention. Consider it. First of all, the first person has only a dry morsel, just a dry morsel. The second person has a house full of sacrifices. Well, the second person has a house full of sacrifices, and he's got all kinds of animals that he can sacrifice, which displays his wealth, and all kinds of the different things that pertain to the sacrifices. He has an abundance of things. He can just go out and grab an animal out of the flock and sacrifice. But the other person doesn't even have enough to make a sacrifice. All he's got is a dry morsel. He can't even offer just a baked meat offering that the Bible talks about. In the book of Leviticus, in chapter number 2, go ahead and turn there. In Leviticus chapter 2, in order for the person to offer what was called a meat offering, he had to have oil with him. And this person only had a dry morsel, so he didn't even have any oil to offer with this thing to give it a little bit of moisture. Leviticus chapter 2, I begin reading with verse 1. And when any will offer a meat offering, now notice how it's used, meat offering. He calls it meat, but there's not going to be any flesh involved. Not going to be any meat and flesh, but he calls it meat, and it's going to be like meal. It's going to be something with dough like that. And when any will offer a meat offering unto the Lord, his offering shall be of fine flour, and he shall pour oil upon it. Notice he's got fine flour with the offering and oil. He pours oil upon it and put frankincense thereon. And he continues mentioning this thing about the oil over and again. Verse 2. And he shall bring it to Aaron's sons, the priests. And he shall take thereout his handful of the flour thereof, and of the oil thereof, with all the frankincense thereof. And the priest shall burn the memorial of it upon the altar to be an offering made by fire of a sweet savor unto the Lord. Go down to verse 4. And if thou bring an oblation of a meat offering, bacon in the oven, it shall be unleavened cakes. He's cooking something. He's cooking like some kind of cakes in the oven. Unleavened cakes of fine flour mingled with oil, or unleavened wafers anointed with oil. So he's got these cakes that are mingled with oil, which gives them some moisture, or they're anointed with oil, so they're not dry. When they're anointed with oil, they're not just a dry morsel. And verse 5, and if thy oblation be a meat offering bacon in the pan, it shall be a fine flour, unleavened, mingled with oil. And you find it again about the oil in verse number, at the end of verse 7. Then go down to verse 15. And you find out they're offering a meat offering in verse 14 of their first fruits unto the Lord. And these are green ears of corn dried by the fire, and they're beaten out of full ears. And then verse 15 it says, and thou shalt put oil upon it, and lay frankincense thereon. It is a meat offering. So he speaks about this meat offering, not meat as we commonly refer to it today, but flour and a dry morsel, as spoken about, morsels that they would not be dry because, I said dry, but they wouldn't be dry because of the oil that would be put upon it, the oil that they'd be baking with or anointed with. Now this shows you that this person in Proverbs 17 verse 1 was poor, didn't have a lot, didn't even have the necessary ingredients to be able to offer just a plain, simple, what the Bible called meat offering to the Lord. All he had was a dry morsel. And yet, the Lord said that he's better off than the person that has all kinds of sacrifices to offer to the Lord, and yet their house is filled with hatred and chaos, as he says here, strife. In other words, like it says in the New Testament, if there first be a willing mind, it is accepted according as a man hath, and not according as he hath not. In other words, the first thing to get is your heart and your mind willing. If you've got a willing mind to be able to please the Lord, yet you don't have a whole bunch of resources to be able to do it like you like to do, then you're accepted. That's acceptable. And he says here, you do better to have not even have enough to offer a legitimate Bible sacrifice than to have plenty to offer the legitimate Bible sacrifice and not to have peace with it. So better is a dry morsel and quietness therewith than a house full of sacrifices with strife. And again, it indicates the characteristics of some households. The happy home is the exception, and it's not the rule. I mean, blessed is the person that has a happy, peaceful home with no contentions and no strife. But it's the exception. It's not the rule. Most houses are filled with contentions. I'll go a step further. Most Christian houses are filled with contentions and strife. Devil gets in. He's got all kinds of ways of getting in, and he doesn't seem to usually fail to try every one of them. And there's usually a weak link in the chain somewhere where he can get in. And you have house. You may have plenty sometimes, or houses may have plenty, but yet if they have the strife with it, then they're not doing any good. Now notice what he said though. Better is a dry morsel and quietness therewith. It's no good to have a dry morsel and then have a house full of strife either. You know, if you have a dry morsel, at least have quietness. But you do better just have a little and have less strife than to have a house filled with sacrifices and have strife. So even being poor doesn't make you peaceful necessarily either. But you've got to have the quietness. And sometimes the houses of plenty, they're not quiet at all. Let me get the other thing out here. But as I said, the happy homes are the exception, and they're not the rule. It's like a kid said to his mommy, or said a boy said to his sister. He said they're looking for something to do, and he said, "Let's play mommy and daddy." And the girl said, "No, that's too rough. Let's play football." There's a lot of truth in that. And then somebody else said, after a man and a woman get together, the first year he talks and she listens. The second year she talks and he listens. And the third year they both talk and the neighbors listen. And those are your houses full of sacrifices with strife. So you want to have a quiet, peaceful household, and you've got the way to get it, of course, is to have that heart right with the Lord. So he does make a comparison, though. Better is a dry morsel and quietness therewith than a house full of sacrifices with strife. Right? The next verse. A wise servant shall have rule over a son that causeth shame, and shall have part of the inheritance among the brethren. Here's a person who's in the household. He becomes a kind of an adopted member of the household in the sense that he is a servant. He's not a son in this case. He may not be. The Old Testament truth of it. He's a foreign member of the household. He's a servant in the household. He lives in the household and is taken care of by the people of the household. And yet he's a servant. And yet it says about this servant that a wise servant shall have rule over a son that causes shame. The indication is this. The son of the household would normally have certain rights being the son. He'd normally have certain dominion. But if that son or that child in the household is a son that causes shame, he gets into trouble a lot and he brings shame to his, and reproach to his parents, then the servant that's wise will end up having rule over the son that's causing shame. When it normally would have been the other way around. Normally it would have been the son, just by his right of inheritance, by his birthright, that would have had dominion over the servant. So it's an indication of how a servant's going to have rule over a son that causes shame. Indication of how that if you get in a position where you might not have natural rights, yet if you're diligent about matters, you may end up having dominion over a place where it wasn't your natural place to have dominion, to have rule. So a wise servant shall have rule over a son that causes shame. Now it can be a son too. It can be the servant can still be a son. For example, Joseph and his brethren. Joseph illustrates this. Joseph, he was a good son, and he was a good servant, and he got in trouble as far as the way his brethren treated him. They left him for dead. He was sold into slavery and went off over into Egypt, and yet in the household of Potiphar and in Pharaoh's household, he was a good servant, and what he did, the Lord made it to prosper. And Joseph did right, and he was diligent, and he was a wise servant. And he had an excellent spirit about him and understanding. And this wise servant, Joseph, ended up having rule over the other sons that caused shame. They got to the place where, I mean, Joseph wasn't the firstborn. The birthright wasn't his. It was Judah's. And then Judah lost it, and Simeon lost it. Levi lost it, Reuben, it was Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. It was Reuben's first, and then Reuben lost it, and then Simeon lost it, and then Levi lost it, and ended up going to Judah. Right? And Judah ended up getting the birthright. But Joseph ended up having dominion over all of them. They ended up being a servant to him. He was a servant, and yet he ended up having rule over the sons that caused shame. The sons that caused shame ended up coming over to him in Egypt and bowing down before him to receive their corn in the time of famine. So that somewhat illustrates the verse. A wise servant shall have rule over a son that causes shame. Then it says, and shall have part of the inheritance among the brethren. Back to the first indications I gave you of the verse, this person who is a servant and not normally having any natural inheritance can end up with an inheritance by his diligent service. Now there's another great truth locked up in this verse, and that's a great New Testament truth. And when you get into your New Testament and read what it has in there, it reveals a greater truth of this verse for the Christian. A wise servant shall have rule over a son that causes shame. As God's people, as born-again Christians, we are both servants and sons. Peter addressed one of his epistles saying that he was a servant of Jesus Christ. And other places, it's talked about how that we're the sons of God. In 1 John chapter 3 and in John chapter 1, talking about how we're the sons of God. And as wise servants, if we will be wise servants of God, servants that serve him with wisdom, getting wisdom, then we'll end up having rule over sons that cause shame, the sons of God that cause shame. This is getting on out into the future. I mean, on out into beginning our eternal years. It has to do with your rewards that you gain. It has to do with your position in the millennial reign of Jesus Christ. And a wise servant during the time of the millennium will end up having rule over a son that causes shame. If you're a wise servant of God, you'll end up having rule over a son of God, a saved Christian, but just was a child, a son, never really got into serving God or never did it with his whole heart, but he caused the Lord shame and he was a son of God that caused shame. You'll end up having rule over him. Now notice how that goes in with the second part of the verse also. And it says, and shall have part of the inheritance among the brethren. If we are wise children and servants of God, we'll get an inheritance and we'll have a part of the inheritance among the brethren that a son that causes shame won't get. The son normally has the right to the inheritance, but if he causes shame, he may just get cut out of the will a little bit, you know. He may lose out on some of his inheritance. You hear him talk about how that when they get mad at... You know, dads get mad at kids when the kids are growing up or something, or they threaten them, you know, I'm going to cut you out of the will, or you kid about it sometimes, and somebody crosses you and say, you're out of the will, something like that. Well, that's about what's going to happen to some Christians. They're going to lose out on the inheritance that they could have had by not serving God with a whole heart. They're going to miss out on their rewards. Now, the key verse in the New Testament to put this all together that shows you that your inheritance is an earned reward is Colossians 3:24, which we've looked at before. But Colossians 3:24 tells you that inheritance is a reward. It's called the reward of the inheritance. And you get rewards by earning it. You work for it. And when you work, you earn the reward. And a person that works, the reward is reckoned of debt. And you earn something, and God gives it to you, and God owes it to you, and He'll give it to you. So if you earn the reward rightfully, you'll get part of the inheritance among the brethren. Now notice how this also fits in with the context of it. You've got a reference to the judgment seat of Christ in the next verse, Proverbs 17, verse 3. The fining pot is for silver and the furnace for gold, but the Lord trieth the hearts. The fining pot is for silver. And when the silver is fined or refined, it's done with fire. When gold is refined or fined, it is done with fire. It's done in a furnace. And when God refines or tries our heart, He's going to try it with fire. So He gives you a comparison between how silver is fined or refined and how gold is refined. And then it says, but the Lord trieth the hearts. And the way the Lord tries the hearts is with fire. We better go to 1 Corinthians 3. And just, though this is a verse we've looked at, let's see how it fits in here. 1 Corinthians 3. And he talks about the inheritance, the rewards you can earn in verse 2 of chapter 17 in Proverbs. And then verse 3. He's into a reference to the judgment seat of Christ and how your works are tried with fire. The Lord trieth the hearts. 1 Corinthians 3, verse 13. 1 Corinthians 3, 13. About the judgment seat. Every man's work shall be made manifest, for the day shall declare it, because it shall be revealed by fire. fire's going to reveal your works. And the fire shall try every man's work of what sort it is. The Lord tries the hearts, and the way he tries it, he tries it with fire. There's going to be a fiery trial at the judgment seat of Christ that we will face, and it's going to try our hearts. It says the Lord trieth the hearts in Proverbs 17:3, and it was compared to how silver and gold was tried with fire. And then in 1 Corinthians 3:13, it said the fire is going to try our works of what sort it is. That means that fire is going to try the heart. It's going to try the motives of the heart. And of what sort it is indicates your motives and indicates the depths of the heart and how your service was really wrought towards the Lord. So Proverbs 17, verse 3, gives you a reference to the New Testament Christians' judgment, the judgment seat of Christ, where it talks about the Lord trying the hearts. Now let's go to the book of Malachi, chapter 3. Malachi 3, let's notice about the trying of silver and the refining of silver. Notice that it's done with fire. Malachi chapter 3. Malachi 3, 2. But who may abide the day of his coming, and who shall stand when he appeareth? For he is like a refiner's fire. Talk about the fining pot for silver. When that refiner finds the silver in the fining pot, it's done with fire. For he is like a refiner's fire and like a fuller's soap. And he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. So you see, the silver is in the context of being refined here. And the way it's refined is with fire. So that's the whole comparison of Proverbs 17, verse 3. Where it talks about the fining pot being for silver and the furnace for gold. It's having our works tried in the fire. The Lord will put our works through the fire. And he says, but the Lord trieth the hearts. Jeremiah 17, verse 10 says, I, the Lord, search the heart. So the Lord does try our hearts, and he tries them with fire. Now, this not only refers to the judgment seat, and the judgment seat of Christ, but also through some fiery trials that we may face here, down here on earth. If you look in the book of Isaiah, chapter 48. But the Lord uses fiery trials and hard times to try our hearts and to refine us a little bit. Sometimes we've got a little excess that needs to be done away with, so the Lord puts us through some trials and hard times to get rid of it. Isaiah 48. We read about the furnace trying the gold, and the silver being fined in the fining pot. Now Isaiah 48, verse 10. Behold, I have refined thee, but not with silver. I have chosen thee in the furnace of affliction. So you've got a reference how silver is refined and gold is refined. Silver being refined in the fire and gold in the furnace. And yet he says here that he's refined, the Lord refined him, but not with silver. And here he said, I have chosen thee in the furnace of affliction. Not the furnace that tries gold, but the furnace of affliction. And it's a comparison. The comparison is just the same way that the silver is put through the fire and refined, and you can purge the dross from it. And just the same way the gold is put through the fire and refined and purified, the same way God does with us. He refines us by putting us through fiery trials. And he says, I have chosen thee in the furnace of affliction. That furnace of affliction, it will be like those fiery trials that you will find yourself afflicted with in life that you'd rather not go through many times, but the Lord puts you through it to get rid of a little excess baggage that doesn't need to be there. He puts you through it so that you can more easily and more properly and more profitably lay aside every weight, the sin which does so easily beset us. Oftentimes we'd be satisfied with just carrying the excess baggage around, but the Lord wants us to get rid of it. And these are things in our life that we don't need. Things in our life that are there, and yet they're getting in our way. They're hindering our spiritual life. So the Lord puts us through rough times sometimes to smooth off the rough edges and touch up the portrait a little bit and make it that much more beautiful. And it's like somebody else said, the way you get a sharp edge on a tool is a grindstone. You can't get a sharp edge on the tool without the grindstone. And the Lord has to sometimes put us to the grindstone so we can become a little bit sharper spiritually, a little bit sharper Christians. And, of course, it hurts. But he's got a purpose involved. And he's not doing it just for the express purpose of hurting you. He's doing it for the express purpose of bringing forth more fruit through your life and helping you out. So Proverbs 17, verse 3, it has a lot in there. It contains a lot of truth. Okay, 17:4. A wicked doer giveth heed to false lips, and a liar giveth ear to a naughty tongue. Here you've got a person who, in his heart, he himself is a wicked doer, and he tends to give ears to lying tongues and false lips. Crooks tend to listen to crooks. Thieves tend to listen to thieves. They tend to go to the like sort for advice and for counsel. They listen to each other and take heed to their counsel. So a wicked doer giveth heed to false lips. If somebody is really a wicked doer, then they tend to listen to somebody else that's telling them something that may not be right and may not be true, and they'll tend to follow them. And a liar giveth ear to a naughty tongue, and they'll tend to listen to them. If a person's a liar, he'll tend to listen to people that tell lies. If a person's a wicked in his heart, he'll tend to follow after other people that are wicked in their heart. So a wicked doer giveth heed to false lips. He'll tend to hear things that aren't right. He'll tend to listen to things that are not true. There's a greater truth I see locked in this verse also. A wicked doer giveth heed to false lips. If you remember in John 7:17, a verse which I refer to a lot myself, but it says, Jesus said, if any man will do his will, he shall know of the doctrine. If a person's willing to do the will of God, then he finds out the right doctrine. And here is the opposite of that. If a person's not willing to do his will, he's a wicked doer. See that doer there, a wicked doer, then he gives heed to false lips. He listens to false doctrine. He'll sit there and be content and satisfied without the truth. When a person's not really sincere in their heart, they'll sit there and you put it right down the line in a lot of modern church services. They'll go there and have their ears tickled, and they'll listen to it and have their back scratched and enjoy it, and go out never under conviction, never with a heart stirred to get right with God or to do anything for the Lord. And they'll listen to it and put up with it because they're not right. They're wicked doers. And it says, a wicked doer giveth heed to false lips. He listens to it and obeys it. And that's one reason why some people don't get their doctrine straight, because they're wicked in their hearts. They're wicked doers. They're not doers of the word. And if you're a doer of the word, then you'll tend to, somebody that's got a heart to it, you'll tend to find out what's right. If you're willing to do his will, then you'll know of the doctrine. And this person, being a wicked doer, was not, at least at this point, willing to do the will of God. So the general truth is, a wicked doer giveth heed to false lips. Not only just hears it, but he obeys it. He heeds it. He follows after it. And then a liar giveth ear to a naughty tongue. He seeks after this type of counsel. And he likes and enjoys to listen, enjoys listening to the naughtiness. Naughty. Notice how the Bible just real practical. With its words, naughty. Just like we say to our kids, naughty, naughty, naughty. The Lord looks down sometimes on his kids and says, naughty, naughty, naughty. He says, give us ear to a naughty tongue. It's a tongue that's not speaking good things and right things at all. Speaking filth and wickedness. Verse 5. Whoso mocketh the poor reproacheth his maker. Notice the terminology here, his maker. We talk about sometimes you're going to meet your maker. And the Bible talks in more than one place about your maker. And that's where they get the expression. And notice the capital M. And it's a definite reference to the Lord, our Creator. Whoso mocketh the poor reproacheth his maker. And he that is glad at calamity shall not be unpunished. It's a person that makes fun of poor people. He mocks them. He ridicules them. Makes fun of poor people. He reproaches his maker. And one of the reasons he does, if you come to Proverbs 22, one of the reasons that it's said that he reproaches his maker is because his maker is the Lord, and when he reproaches the poor, he reproaches the one that made him. Proverbs 22:2. The rich and poor meet together. The Lord is the maker of them all. The Lord makes both the rich and he makes the poor also. So if you're poor, blame God. The Lord makes the rich and he makes the poor. And you can't always blame them if you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. But the Lord makes the rich people and he makes the poor people. And this verse in Proverbs 17 says, whoso mocketh the poor reproacheth his maker. You're approaching the maker of the poor. If you're making fun of a person that's poor, a person that's legitimately poor. He maybe doesn't have a lot of advantages that somebody else has. He works, he tries, does his best. But doesn't seem to get ahead like the Rockefellers or somebody else. But if you approach a person like that, then you're approaching your maker, because God's the one that made him. So a slander against a person like that is taking a shot at God. Whoso reproacheth the poor, or mocketh the poor rather, reproacheth his maker. Come to Proverbs chapter 24. Just hold it there for a moment. And I'll look at the second half of the verse in chapter 17. 17:5, second half of the verse. And he that is glad at calamity shall not be unpunished. This is a person that rejoices when somebody gets in trouble, somebody else has trouble. Proverbs 24. Notice that this is not the way we're supposed to act. Proverbs 24, verse 17. Rejoice not when thine enemy falleth, and let not thine heart be glad when he stumbleth. When our enemy falls and our enemy's having a rough time, we're not to rejoice. We're not to let our hearts be glad when he falls, when he gets in trouble. Of course, we have a hard time with this. Kids have a hard time with this, you know. When their brother or sister is getting in trouble and getting spanked, and the other kids are sitting on the couch just sitting there like an angel with a big smile on his face, you know. But kids tend to be like that, and they're not supposed to. Wicked, rotten, bad hearts. But he says, he that is glad at calamity shall not be unpunished. That's where it starts. That's the kind of attitude you get. But what we're supposed to realize is that when our enemies fall and our people, or the people that we see that are against God and against us, when they have a hard time and rough time, we're not supposed to rejoice at it. We're supposed to be pleading for mercy for them while they've got a chance and while they've got time. And we're not supposed to enjoy it. There'll come a time when we will get to rejoice at the destruction of the wicked. Because in Proverbs 18, they're rejoicing at the fall of Babylon. And so that the Lord's getting ready to do away with things, and you'll be able to rejoice then. But not now. But you read about that in Revelation 18, when Babylon's fallen and they get to rejoice over it. But here, with our individual enemies, we're not supposed to rejoice. We're not supposed to be happy. And it says, and he that is glad at calamity shall not be unpunished. Let me show you a person that fulfilled this verse, in that he was not glad at calamities. Job 31. Job was a man who didn't rejoice when his enemy fell, and didn't rejoice when his enemy stumbled. Job 31. Job 31, Job's here, he's pleading his righteousness and his cause, and he's letting it fly. Remember, he's just on and on about everything he's done, and giving the testimony to how good he's been and how right he's been. He said, look at verse, I'll just pick it up. It goes on for a while. He starts off in the early verses, and he goes on. I'll just pick it up in verse number 23. He says, for destruction from God was a terror to me, and by reason of his highness I could not endure. Now watch him start coming along. If I have made gold my hope, or said to the fine gold, thou art my confidence. If I rejoiced because my wealth was great, and because mine hand had gotten much. And he's implying that he didn't do these things. He's implying that he's right because he didn't act like this. Go on down to verse 28. If he did all this, this also were an iniquity to be punished by the judge, for I should have denied the God that is above. Now, verse 29. If I rejoiced at the destruction of him that hated me, or lifted up myself when evil found him. And then he said, neither have I suffered my mouth to sin by wishing a curse to his soul. Job, pleading his righteousness, talks about how that he did not desire the fall of his enemies. He didn't rejoice at the destruction of a person that hated him, which definitely would be his enemy. And he didn't lift up himself when his person that was against him was overtaken with evil. And then he says, neither have I suffered my mouth to sin by wishing a curse to his soul. He didn't talk bad about him, and he didn't say, well, he had it coming to him. You know, he deserved it. And sure is good that we got rid of that person. Sure is good that he finally got his just deserts. The Bible says about the Lord, with the merciful, he will show himself merciful. If you want mercy from God, you ought to have mercy on other people. And with the froward, he'll show himself froward. So if you want God to be merciful, I mean, be merciful to other people. We get self-righteous after we get saved too easily. And the Bible says, be kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. Wasn't for the grace of God, we'd be in a good case today, wouldn't we? And we've got to remember that God forgave us, so we ought to be merciful to others, and even to our enemies. So this gets down to some real refined Christianity when you get down to it, getting down to some of the pure things, the pure stuff. He that is glad at calamity shall not be unpunished. And Proverbs 17, verse 5 indicates that a person that's like that will get punished from him, won't get away with it. Look in the book of Obadiah. Give you one more verse about this. Obadiah. Obadiah, a little book, just one chapter. Minor prophets. Hosea, Joel, Amos, and Obadiah. Obadiah in verse number 12. And watch the rebuke come to the person that's being written to here. Obadiah 12. But thou shouldest not have looked on the day of thy brother in the day that he became a stranger. Neither shouldest thou have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction. Here Judah was getting destroyed and the children of Judah faced destruction and somebody rejoiced over them. And they shouldn't have done it. And it says, neither shouldest thou have spoken proudly in the day of distress. Here the people of Judah had trouble and they were in distress and having a hard time. And somebody spoke proud about them. And that's what causes us to rejoice when our enemies fall, is our own pride. And Proverbs says, he that is glad at calamity shall not be unpunished. So it shows you how we ought to have a different attitude towards people that are against us. We're to bless them which curse us, bless and curse not. We're to pray for those that despitefully use us. And vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. There's another good verse in the book of Proverbs that talks about if we do have this type of an attitude, and we do rejoice when our enemy falls, then the Lord will see it and he'll turn away his wrath from it. And the Lord, in other words, sometimes the Lord wants to punish the wicked person, but he doesn't want us being happy when he does it. It's like sometimes a parent has to punish his child, but he doesn't want all the other kids sitting there being happy when the other child's getting punished. And when their hearts are really together, they'll tend to feel for them. The punishment of another sometimes brings sobs to the other people that really have a heart for them and love them. Proverbs 17, verse 5, then, at the end, and he that is glad at calamity shall not be unpunished. Okay, let's see, we'll go on, at least start into verse 6. 17:6, children's children are the crown of old men. Okay, children's children, that's going to be grandchildren. You're like your children's children. Children's children are the crown of old men. Be like your grandchildren there. You have kids and then they have kids. And the glory of children are their father. Okay, first of all, some spiritual truths about this. Children's children are the crown. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 19, but the Bible talks about how that the people that were won, the people that Paul had dealt with and instructed and won to Jesus Christ, was his crown. Are not ye our joy and crown of rejoicing in the presence of our Lord Jesus Christ? And when we win souls and people get saved, they'll turn around and be crowns to us as we serve the Lord with proper hearts and right hearts. And it'll be a crown that we'll earn, can earn, or crowns, many crowns that we can earn at the judgment seat of Christ, the crowns of souls that we win. Now then spiritually, verse 6, children's children are the crown of old men, spiritually speaking. You've got a man that was walking in the right ways, and this man instructed his children the right way, and his children won his own children to the Lord, like you winning your own kids to the Lord, and then your kids grew up to have kids. In this case, his kids grew up to have kids, and those kids won their own kids to the Lord. So it's a heritage. It's you. Well, you planted a seed so deep and something so deep in the hearts of your own kids that they got a hold of it, got saved themselves, and then they brought up their kids the same way, and their kids got saved. And then this shows how that children's children can be a crown to the crown of old men. It can be your crown, crown of rejoicing, knowing that you had a part in the salvation of your own grandchildren when you get up there to receive your rewards at the judgment seat of Christ. Children's children are the crown of old men. So you win your children, and your children win their children. There's also just a normal truth about people in here that shows children's children are the crown of old men. It indicates how people just like to, or grandpas and grandmas too, they just like to rejoice about their grandchildren. You see these bumper stickers, ask me about my grandchildren, things like that. That's another truth of this verse. Children's children are the crown of old men. They just enjoy their grandchildren. They enjoy their grandkids, especially when the first ones start rolling around. Children's children are the crown of old men. And the glory of children are their fathers. The glory of children are their fathers. That's an interesting statement. But what children glory in is their fathers, their dads. The glory of children are their fathers. Now, we as children of God, our glory is our Heavenly Father. It should be. As sons of God, we should glory in the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. And He should be our glory. But there's an earthly truth in this too. The glory of children is their fathers. Like kids say, you know, my dad can whip your dad. They glory in their fathers. And kids always talking about what their dads do and the accomplishment that their dads make and what their dads did when they were younger and things like that, and always boasting about their dads. And that's the truth about this here too. So children's children are the crown of old men, and the glory of children are their fathers. And spiritually speaking too, spiritual children tend to rejoice in their spiritual fathers, as Timothy with Paul, and Onesimus with Paul, no doubt rejoicing in Paul, their spiritual father. So, interesting verse, and the Bible seems to touch all the bases at one time or another. But it's amazing when you think about this, and I realize the truth of it, how that kids, well, grandkids really love their, or grandparents really love their grandkids, and you see how kids really rejoice in their own dads, and then you get reading along the Bible, and here's a verse that states it right there all the time. I mean, you observe the truth, and then the Bible states the truth that you've already observed. So, Lord, like I say, He covers all the bases. Okay, we'll close there this morning, about out of time, and take a break. Lord, main service.